This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. There are many steps in the voting process, remembering to update your registration, requesting an absentee ballot, or making sure you can get to the polls on a busy schedule. But for some eligible voters, there are even greater hurdles in exercising the right to vote.
They used to just charge black people with just anything. They could be walking down the street and just get a charge. A felony at that.
Yeah, so you
they
can't
keep
vote.
Them from voting.
Yeah.
And then what they would do, they would take the polls or the actual voting polls out of the town so that they couldn't get to them. It was amazing.
And this isn't just something that used to happen. Voter suppression in the U.S., born from the Jim Crow era, continues to affect voters today, particularly African Americans. Leonita Inge is WUNC's race and Southern culture reporter and one of the hosts of WUNC's Tested podcast. She recently reported the story of one woman who is charged with voter fraud. Leonita, welcome back.
Hi there, Frank.
That clip we just heard was Lanisha Bratcher-Jones, who voted in the 2016 election, not thinking she was doing anything wrong, and then in 2019 was charged with voter fraud. Tell us what happened.
Well, she was charged with voter fraud because she voted in 2016 when she was still on probation. And, you know, that's the law still in North Carolina. She was convicted of a felony in 2013. And she actually, she did not serve any time in jail for that particular felony. She just, you know, there was a plea bargain and she went home. And then in 2016, because she grew up in Hope County, she lives actually in Wake County now, but in Hope County, when she went to fill out her voter registration form and actually vote, she ended up on a list of many people in North Carolina who voted when I guess they didn't know they were not, you know, eligible to vote.
And she was on, as you say, she was on probation, so she was not incarcerated, but was not aware of the fact that if you're on probation, at least in the state of North Carolina, you're not eligible. So let's talk about how the process works, because after the 2016 elections, the State Board of Elections conducted an audit, which is how they identified Lanisha's vote. What were the findings of the audit, and how many illegally cast votes were actually prosecuted?
Well, that audit actually turned up about 500 improperly cast votes. Now, what's so amazing about that, almost all of them, like well over 400 of them, were people who voted on felony parole. You know, it wasn't people pretending to be their grandmother necessarily or, you know, some other dead relative or voting two or three times. There were literally 441 of those people were not in jail for their felony charges. They had served their time and then they were on parole. But I guess really being on parole means you, in this state, you've definitely not completed your time. So those cases, the Board of Elections actually referred all those cases to local prosecutors all over the state. But then in most cases, almost all of the cases, those cases were dismissed, except in two counties, and that's Alamance County and Hope County, where Lanisha Bratcher-Jones lived at the time. And those two district attorneys actually brought charges. And in the cases in Hope County, about five people were indicted for voter fraud. And in Alamance County, about 12 people. And the other thing that was very common amongst these people, they were all black. And if you get to talk to them of what I've heard, you know, and people who have spoken with them, you know, they said they actually they did not know. They had no idea that, you know, being still on parole, that meant that they couldn't vote.
It's interesting to hear how arbitrarily it is enforced in this state. Only in two counties were out of these 441 cases were there actual prosecutions. And in every case, they're black. So how do felony disenfranchisement laws affect particularly black people trying to vote?
Well, it definitely differs based on what state you live in. You know, in North Carolina, many would say that these laws have been on the books for like 100 years, actually, and really haven't been been changed. And of course, they say that these particular, that particular law, the one that's, I guess, being used against, you know, Lanisha Bratcher Jones, is definitely always had racial intent behind it. You know, like she said in her opening comment, that, you know, we can go back to the Jim Crow South, you know, with some incidents where people of color were not just encouraged to not try to vote. In some cases, they were even killed, tortured, let's just say convincingly convinced not to vote, and that their lives depended depended on it. And as a matter of fact, one of the strictest laws in North Carolina actually came about after the 1898 massacre, literally, in Wilmington, where black businesses were torched and people were run out of town, pretty much. And just to really set a tone, like, that black people will not have a voice, you know, in this state, and definitely not in Wilmington. That was really, at that time, one of the most prosperous cities in North Carolina.
So the laws vary, and then the level of education, whether or not people actually realize, you know, that they may not be eligible to vote, at least in this state. I mean, felony voting laws vary state to state. In North Carolina, people convicted of felonies can vote upon the completion of their sentence, but that includes any kind of post-incarceral court supervision. Just north of us in Virginia, all people with felony convictions lose their right to vote until they ask for it to be restored. So let's hear what Lanisha had to say about what education she got about voting before and after her conviction.
I had a sentence to serve for 36 months, and no one had informed me of voting. I was never educated on it. We don't talk about it in school. It's not a thing, per se. So it was never discussed. So I never knew. My probation officers, the judge, the DA, no one ever told me about voting, or if I even had the right to vote, or that my rights were stripped from me at that time.
That's Lanisha Bratcher Jones, who was charged with a felony after voting while on probation in 2016. I'm talking to Leonita Inge, WUNC's race and Southern culture reporter, one of the hosts of the Tested podcast. Leonita, will Lanisha be able to vote in this year's election?
Well, she says she will. She says definitely. She says because she is eligible to vote in Wake County. She's, you know, that her probation has been served, and so that particular case is over now. The problem is she's kind of due back in court even this week, because the district attorney, assistant district attorney in Hope County, Mike Hardin, is still pushing forward with, you know, two felony voter fraud cases against her, and that she could end up in jail if convicted of those. And really, she's being charged with, in a way, she falsely swear with regard to any matter pertaining to, it's a really broad, you know, charge, and under the law, a matter pertaining to like any election primary. Like, so the bottom line is she's not being charged with felony voter fraud for actually casting a vote. She's being charged with a felony for filling out the paperwork.
Well she is. So go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I just said we're going to see how that, you know, that goes in court.
And she has vowed to follow it through. She's been very vocal about her story and planning to continue to fight the charges. Let's listen.
I don't want to take a plea. I want to, if I can get my peers to understand what I've been going through. If we were not dealing with COVID and me being pregnant, I would actually be out there marching and protesting and getting the word out, you know. One thing I wanted to do was to go to the voting polls in North Carolina, in my county or surrounding areas, and inform us black voters, hey, listen, make sure that you're eligible. Make sure that you can, you know, make sure that this is something that you know you can do. Don't get caught up, because you will fall, and they will get you.
That was Lanisha Bratcher Jones, who was charged with a felony after voting while on probation in 2016. I'm talking to Leonita Inge, WNC's race and Southern culture reporter and the host of the Tested podcast. Leonida, what do we know much about that? You said there's only a handful of cases in the state that were actually prosecuted out of that audit from the 2016 election. Do we know much about the disposition of any of the other cases?
Well, I know in the Hope County cases, you know, there were five African-Americans charged with voter fraud. I actually heard one person is no longer living, and that all the others have actually accepted a plea bargain to a misdemeanor. You know, so their cases, I think, are pretty much have ended now. So I know in Hope County, only Lanisha is still fighting this case, and I think she's due in court later this week. Actually, it's the hearing. Sort of a gag order. I think Hope County is tired of people like me and our political reporter Jeff DeBerry talking to Lanisha about this about this case. So that's one of the issues that's supposed to be heard this week.
You can talk to Lanisha all you want. It's talking to the public they don't want. Guest is Leonida Inge, WNC race and Southern culture reporter, one of the hosts of the WNC Tested podcast. Thanks, Leonida.
Thank you.
We've got links to her reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. More than 1 million people have requested absentee ballots from the North Carolina Board of Elections as of yesterday. Now, with the coronavirus pandemic posing health risks to in-person voting, the North Carolina legislature passed a bill to ease the process of absentee voting. But some ballots have already been rejected for errors. The State Board of Elections is in the middle of a settlement process with plaintiffs to address concerns about the correction rules. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central University and joins us now. Irv, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. Anxious about what we're facing here. We've heard a lot about changes in mail-in voting and the process aimed at hopefully increasing voter access and ensuring that people's votes get counted. Should we worry, and what should we worry, who should we worry about when we talk about making changes to the absentee voting process?
Well, traditionally, African-Americans and people of color have not voted by mail. They prefer to go to the polling place to actually cast a ballot and to watch the ballot being processed through the machine, because there's a lot of mistrust historically about this process. But now with the COVID-19, it is anticipated that roughly 40 to 45% of registered voters in the state will use the mail-in ballot in order to minimize any possible harm from COVID-19. Particularly impacted by this are people who have limited mobility, obviously people who are immune compromised, people who are in nursing homes or congregate facilities and can't get out to the polling place and in a position to stand in line for a long period of time in order to vote. So those are the basic populations that will be impacted by or being impacted by this mail-in process.
And with all of that in mind, there was a bipartisan bill that actually passed in June, House Bill 1169, to make some changes to make voting by mail easier. What changes did that bill make to the voting process, the mail-in voting process?
Well, a key change that was made was to reduce the number of witnesses who needed to actually sign off on the ballot. The person who was voting obviously had to sign the ballot, and the prior law had it that two witnesses who watched that person sign their ballot would have to also sign as witnesses, or one person who was a notary public could sign. Under the new iteration, under 1169, only one witness is required. So in addition to the person who is casting the ballot and their signature, then you have to have one witness. Then that has to be placed in a prepackaged envelope and sealed, placed in the mail with sufficient postage attached to it, and then delivered back to the Board of Elections, and it has to be postmarked by the end of the day on November 3rd, and has to arrive at the Board of Election no more than 3 days after November 3rd. So those were the new changes that's envisioned or that's mandated through the 1169 process.
And as we said, that bill actually passed with bipartisan support from this legislature. But then in August and September, we saw a number of lawsuits filed against the State Board of Elections over some remaining concerns about voter access following the changes. So what were these concerns, and who filed these lawsuits?
Well, the Democratic Party, National Democratic Party, had a team to come in to talk with people who were disabled and people who had would encounter problems getting someone to come to their homes to be able to serve as witnesses, or who might otherwise be disabled in the voting process. And that is now the subject of the settlement discussions that's going on.
The State Board of Elections is a majority Democrat, and it came to a settlement with some of the lawsuits that changes, you know, kind of what happens if the vote is rejected by the board, right? That was one of the key questions. What happens if the board rejects a mail-in ballot for one reason or another? Some mail-in ballots have already been rejected, many of them because they had issues about this witness, how the witness signed the ballot. So how does the settlement change the process and for rectifying any errors that the board might find?
Well, it allows for a certification process where the voter is able to certify to specific deficiencies, one where the voter did not sign it, where the voter signed the ballot in the wrong place or the envelope in the wrong place, where the witness didn't print their name properly or didn't sign it properly, or the signature was in the on the wrong line. And in those instances, they determined that those were curable mistakes. And then by certificate, the person who whose ballot it was could prepare a certificate and then be allowed to cure rather than to reject the ballot. It is only where the envelope that the ballot came in was unsealed, or the voter has requested a replacement ballot, that the vote or the ballot would be actually rejected and not subject to the curing process.
All right. But then even while working on that settlement, the Board of Elections faces another lawsuit, North Carolina Republican Party suing the board over the mail-in rule changes. Their concern is that the changes will open the path for fraud to occur. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that that's more political than real. The Board of Election has an excellent process in place that serves to guarantee the validity of the ballot that comes in, allows for people to trace their ballot, and for anyone else to have a paper trail that they can trace all of these ballots that that are coming in. And I think that in response to really, I think, political rhetoric from the president, there is an effort now to grease the litigation process so that these ballots can be challenged in the event that the president comes out on the short end of the vote.
Of course, if we think of election fraud in this state, we have a rather fresh memory back in 2018. 9th Congressional District, of course, that was a Republican involved in that. Refresh us on what happened in that election and what changes the state made to elections to prevent a repeat.
Well, that was a ballot harvesting scheme where individuals would go out into the community with requests for absentee ballots, and then they would, once those ballots were received, then they would help the person to process their ballot, and then they would take the ballot en masse either to the Board of Election, all of which was improper because the law at that time said that a person who completed a mail-in ballot could either return it, the ballot to the Board of Election themselves, or they could have a close family member to return it and put it in the mail. And what this balloting harvesting scheme included was an effort to actually pick up those ballots, and people were not sure that their ballots were ever counted, because if they voted for the wrong person, then there was the likelihood that that ballot would not be presented to the Board of Elections. So that's why you have this tracing process in place and numbering that attaches the ballot to a particular envelope, and then that has to be sealed in that envelope. So there is a more protective process that is in place to ensure the integrity of that mail-in ballot.
I'm talking to Irving Joyner, law professor at North Carolina Central University. And of course, changes to mail-in voting are not the only thing that can cause confusion this year. For those planning to vote in person, there are many lingering questions about how to find the proper polling place, what safety precautions will be in place, and exactly what's needed to cast a ballot. Luckily for North Carolina voters, there are people whose job it is to be on call on election day to answer these questions. There are volunteers called election protectors, and one of them is with us now, Vicki Shea, a member of the League of Women Voters, a volunteer for Democracy NC's Election Protection Program, and an election protector. She works to make sure that everybody has a smooth election day. Vicki, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us what you're going to be doing election day. And I guess, of course, we have early voting in the state. So are you there? Election protectors will be there whenever the polls are open?
Well, election protectors will be there on the first day of early voting and on the last day of early voting, so October 15th and October 31st, and then election day itself, November 3rd.
And tell us what you'll be doing on those days.
Well, on October 15th, the election protectors are doing what's called roving, going from polling place to polling place and just looking to see whether there are logistical problems such as very long lines, or the polling place has run out of ballots or didn't open on time, that kind of thing. On the 31st, that Saturday, that's the last day of voting, I'm actually going to do a traditional election protection role, and the same on election day, which involves standing outside the polls in a socially distanced way, letting voters know that there are election protectors available in case they're having individual problems, such as being told that they're not registered or that they're in the wrong place. We can then help to connect them with a voter hotline, which is staffed by attorneys and law students specially trained in North Carolina election law.
And on that first day, do you have any sort of authority to, let's say you see there's congestion or there's difficulties getting to the polls. Can you do anything about it? Do you report it? How much authority do you have to fix it?
Yeah, everything we do is based on calling the hotline, which is 888 Our Vote, which is staffed, as I said, by lawyers and law students. And they handle all of the issues that come up because they're much more knowledgeable. We as election protectors don't need to be skilled in election law. And in fact, we're looking for new volunteers who will be trained and deployed. And what we do is get the election protection hotline folks on the phone, let them know the issues, and they decide whether this is something to escalate to the Board of Elections of the county or even to the State Board of Elections.
Irv Joyner, you have been involved in efforts to increase education about voting among vulnerable populations like students. Tell us what you're doing and what you're hearing from students and other people about, their anxieties about voting or their enthusiasm about voting this cycle.
Well, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm. There is a lot of anxiety, particularly as a result of COVID-19. And so you have a large group of students who are not on campus, and they are concerned about identifying the appropriate polling site, whether they are going to use mail-in ballots or whether they are going to vote during the early voting period. And we are strongly advising people to vote early, whether it is by mail-in ballots. We are urging people to mail those ballots in now or to request them now. As for early voting, we are urging people to vote early in the process from day one, and don't put it off until the last day, which is typically a very busy day at the polling site. And then we're adding some information about how to properly complete the mail-in ballots. Since we've had reports of a lot of ballots being rejected, then we want to try to help people to better understand what the requirements are to ensure that we don't have to utilize the curing process. But in the event that the curing process becomes necessary, that they understand exactly how to get that done.
And Irv, I know there's been some confusion over what kind of ID or any, what sort of identification we're going to be required to show this time around. What do people need in terms of voter ID this year?
You do not need photo ID to vote. If you are already registered, then you just show up at the polling place and answer the questions from the registrar that is there. If you're going in to vote for the first time, to register and vote for the first time during the early voting period, then you will have to bring some information with your name and address on it, a utility bill that shows your address and shows your name, a check stub, or some other information that the person has received at the home, the address that they are using as the residence for the registration. But other than that, a photo state issued ID is not required.
Vicki, I wonder what you've heard from voters about election protectors. Do they know that they have this kind of protection? And to the extent that they do, how important do people feel it is to have people like you at the polls?
I don't think most people know at the time that they're going to the polls that there will be election protectors there. But in my experience, when we announce by calling out or just talking to people and say we're nonpartisan election protection volunteers, let us know if you have any problems. In my experience, people just relax a little bit. They just, you see their shoulders go down and they give a faint smile. And it just adds a layer of reassurance that somebody is there watching, just a regular person watching and with access to resources if they do have some kind of problem.
What about the people who are doing this job, other volunteers like yourself? There's been so much anxiety about this whole election, what it's going to look like, whether or not it's secure, whether or not there are going to be people tampering with these results. A lot of concern this time around. What are you hearing from the election protectors, other volunteers, about their role and sort of going into this job?
Well, I think all of us who volunteer to do this are just so strongly invested in the idea that all eligible voters should be able to vote that we're willing to go out there and do this because it's just so important for democracy. This particular program is also taking care of volunteers by really stressing wearing masks, staying at a distance from, you know, any of the voters that we're talking to. And so there's a sense that the organization of Democracy North Carolina is looking out for the volunteers as well as for the voters. And so I just made the decision, this is too important to stay home, and I decided to do it all three of the days.
Vicki Shea is a volunteer for Democracy North Carolina's Election Protection Program. Irving Joyner is a law professor at North Carolina Central University. Thank you both for being here today.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org.